All right. Today we're going to talk about DNA, its structure, its function, a little bit about the history of how it was elucidated, its role in biology. So here's a general timeline of the understanding of the role of DNA in genetics. And some of the bigger ones that we'll talk about today, Griffith demonstrating the transforming principle. When we were talking about horizontal transfer and bacteria the other day, the one process of transformation, it gets its name because bacteria are transformed. Griffith utilized that principle. And we'll briefly cover some of these others, and then we'll talk about Watson and Crick and how they ripped off Rosalind Franklin briefly. Okay. So we'll start with, it came down to after Mendel had done his work, and after then cell biologists had been able to track chromosomes moving in the cell, that they thought, okay, these chromosome things look like good candidates. Chromosomes have DNA and protein. And so then it became really a situation of trying to demonstrate which one of those macromolecules was the one that provided information in the cells. So they set up one of the experiments that was done was with virulent bacteria. And virulent just means it's able to cause disease. And they would go through and break down individual classes of molecules and then see if the remaining molecules could transform non-virulent bacteria. So bacteria that couldn't cause disease. The bacteria that was typically used, it's depending on which book you read, they either use the old name or they use the new name. The new name is Streptococcus pneumoniae. It's a gram-positive bacteria. It's very common in the back of your throat, and it produces a capsule. So it's got this slimy coat. This is the bacterial cell. It sort of looks like a fried egg when I drew it up here, but then this capsule is very sticky, mucus-like material. And in Streptococcus pneumoniae's world, this capsule is what gives it the ability to cause disease. It uses the capsule to adhere to the back of your throat. And also this capsule is made up of carbohydrates. And the immune system doesn't see carbohydrates as well as it sees proteins. And especially in kids under the age of 5. One of the reasons why kids under the age of 5 are more prone to bacterial meningitis is because there are a couple bacteria in the back of the throat that coat themselves in sugars, and their immune system just really doesn't see it. So if this one of those bacteria can spread to the bloodstream, the immune system doesn't really keep it in check, then it can make the jump from the bloodstream to the central nervous system and cause meningitis. So there's actually now a vaccine against Streptococcus pneumoniae. It's called the Prevnar vaccine, and kids get it 3 shots before they're 5 years old. They typically get the 3 Prevnar shots before they're 2. But the whole ability of this bacterium to cause disease is based on the genes encoding this capsule. Okay. And so if you get a mutation of, I'll draw it in red, of strep pneumoniae that doesn't produce a capsule, you still have a bacterial cell, but this bacterium can't cause disease. And so the model system that they use is if you inject this bacterium into the bloodstream of a mouse, you'll cause an infection of the bloodstream and the mouse will die from a fever and multiple organ failure. If you inject this into the bloodstream of a mouse, the mouse may spike a little bit of a fever, but their immune system can clear it out before it gets very sick. So virulent, avirulent, just based on the presence or absence of the capsule. So what they did is they took virulent bacterial cells, and they lysed the cells, and then they did that three times. We've got three trials that are run in parallel. And so to this tube, they added an enzyme that selectively destroys RNA. Okay, in this tube, they added protease, an enzyme that selectively destroys all the protein in the sample. And then in this third tube, they added DNAs, which destroys DNA and leaves protein and RNA intact. What had been shown before is if you just do this experiment without adding these enzymes, it'd be nice if they had the control over here. If you do this, take this cell lysate from virulent cells and you add it to a mixture of avirulent cells, what will happen is you will transform the avirulent cells so that some of them become virulent. Okay? So you don't have any living virulent cells. You've lysed them, you've killed all of them, but you're just taking component parts. And you expose these avirulent cells to it. They take up the genetic information and they start producing a capsule, is what happens. So this experiment was designed to determine, was it the DNA, the protein, or the RNA from the virulent cells that was transforming the avirulent cells to the point where they could cause disease. Okay, so after they treat with these enzymes and they mix it in with avirulent bacteria, allow it to incubate for a little bit, then they come in and look, and in the RNase treated lysate, you still got virulent cells. So these red cells down here show that some of the avirulent cells had been transformed and were now virulent. Same thing with protein, you got virulent cells that formed. And in this one where the DNase was destroyed, you didn't get any transformation to virulence. So through this experiment, they determined that it was DNA that was the transforming agent, and more than likely it was DNA that was the molecule that stored biological information. Okay. Then there were a couple of other experiments that were going on at about the same time, and one of them utilizes bacteriophage. So bacteriophage are viruses that infect bacteria. And here we've got some phage that are present on this bacterium. They've got this capsid head, and then they've got tails, and it's basically an injection mechanism. These viruses act like a syringe, and they inject their genome inside. So they inject DNA inside of the cells. Okay. But all of these structures outside are made of protein. Okay. And viruses, remember that one of the three ways of horizontal transfer is transduction. Viruses have the ability to change the way in which bacterial cells function. And so it was understood then that bacteriophage provide genetic information. And so at the time they were trying to determine which of the classes of macromolecules was going in. So basically a virus, it's got its genome packaged in this capsid head. There's not much else to a virus except its genome and a protein capsid and delivery mechanism. Okay. And so when the virus injects its genome, we talked about this the other day, it can lyse the bacterial chromosome. It tends not to do that immediately. But again, that game of cooties or the tank driving into the Mitsubishi motor plant, that the cell just starts making components of other of new viruses. They get assembled where you get a genome into a capsid. You get a tail unit attached there, and then the viruses leave. Okay. So in this experiment, they were trying to determine between proteins and nucleic acids which ones got inside of the cells. Okay. This is at a time when it was a little bit tougher to do this kind of stuff. So they took advantage of some differences in the composition of the macromolecules. So they labeled, in this experiment, they labeled the proteins in an E. coli or in the virus. They did it by labeling a bacterial strain that the virus would infect. When the viruses were liberated, we've got this strain of virus, and all of its proteins are labeled with S35. So a radioactive form of sulfur. You don't find sulfur in nucleic acids. So S35 would not label nucleic acids. It would only label proteins. And in this strain, the virus has been labeled with P32. So the nucleic acids would be radioactive, and we'd be able to trace those, but the proteins would not be labeled with P32. Okay? So then they allowed the viruses to interact with a new unlabeled, so non-radioactive E. coli line, bacterial cell line that the viruses would infect. And then partway through the infection, they take the virus-bacteria mixture, they put them in a tissue homogenizer, which is the scientific way of saying blender. It's the way that manufacturers, Waring produces a lot of fine scientific tissue homogenizers that look an awful lot like the bar blenders that I spent one-third as much on as a tissue homogenizer. If you want to go into science, go into the right end, go into the supply side of science, because that's where all the money is charging people like me huge amounts of money to do experiments. It doesn't matter if the experiment works or not. Once you sell the blender, you sell the blender. And tissue homogenizers are really useful. Depending on the settings, you can break off things at a pretty good discretionary limit. So in this case, you set the blender so that it's just going to shear off the viruses off of the bacterial cells. And it does that pretty thoroughly and completely. Then you take the mixture and you spin it down in a centrifuge. The bacterial cells are dense enough that they will precipitate out, they'll pellet out, but the viral capsids are light enough that they will stay in the supernatant. They'll stay in suspension. So they did that with both of these, and then they looked to see where the radio label was. It was known that the viruses could transduce the cells. The virus was introducing something to the bacterial cell that was changing them. So what they were looking for was whether S35 label or P32 label was making it into the bacterial cells. So in the case of the S35 label, what they found is all the radio label stayed in the supernatant. It was still associated with the viral capsids. Okay? And when they looked at the bacterial pellet, there was no appreciable amount of S35. So none of the viral proteins had actually made it inside of the bacterial cells. When they looked at the P32 label, there was very little P32 in the supernatant. And when they looked at the bacterial pellet, almost all of the P32 had been incorporated into the bacterial pellet, suggesting that the viruses did inject their DNA while the protein shell stayed on the outside. So that further solidified the view that DNA was the molecule of information, and it was the long-term storage molecule for biological information. So then it became a race. Once it was determined that it wasn't proteins, it was DNA, then it became a race to come up with the structure of DNA. And it really was sort of the biological version of the Holy Grail, that it was a lot of groups were heavily invested in being the first group there. And the way in which it was done was through X-ray crystallography. There were some other scientists that were, they were looking at other components of DNA, so Chargaff came up with a really big idea. We'll go back to the timeline real quick. So we've got Chargaff here. Chargaff had determined that when he looked at DNA from, I think his original study had 9 different species, that when you look at the bases, that the concentration of A was roughly equal to that of T, and the concentration of G was roughly equal to that of C. His specific experimentation was not precise enough that he could say that they were equal, and in fact, Chargaff didn't think that that was an important finding. Chargaff told Watson at a cocktail party that Watson was reading too much into his research and that he thought he just picked a peculiar small number of species, and he was proposing to look at like 50 more species, and he thought that those ratios would wander away from 1 to 1. But he was wrong. So Watson and Crick actually did no wet science. They took Chargaff's ratios of A being roughly being equal to T, G roughly being equal to C, and they took that as for every A you'll get a T, and for every G you'll get a C. Chargaff did the experimentation, Watson and Crick didn't, but Chargaff didn't believe it. So that was on him. Okay. But Watson and Crick, they thought their main competition was actually Linus Pauling. Linus Pauling had elucidated the structure of an enzyme, and it's one of the few people that have won 2 Nobel Prizes. But then he caught a lot of bad press because he later in his life put a lot of stock in vitamin C, mega doses of vitamin C. But so they were worried about Linus Pauling coming up with the structure of this molecule. His nephew, Peter Pauling, was a postdoc just down the hall from Watson and Crick. So they kind of paid Peter off, and he would give them updates on what his uncle was working on. And then they worked right next door to Maurice Wilkins. And Maurice Wilkins had a postdoc in his lab, Rosalind Franklin, who was an X-ray crystallographer. She was actually doing the experimentation to elucidate the structure of DNA, which involved crystallizing the DNA. You bounce X-rays through it, you get this diffraction pattern, and if you're somebody that does this a lot, you can look at these diffraction patterns and figure out some physical properties of the molecule that you're looking at. And so Franklin was doing that for Wilkins. He had a grant proposal that was due, and so when you submit a grant, if you want to get it renewed, you've got to share your preliminary results with the granting agency. So Franklin really didn't want to share her results. She wanted to publish them all at once. She was looking at 3 different forms of DNA that can form, and she just wanted to publish them all at one time. But Wilkins had this grant renewal, so she gave him the information. And Wilkins was sitting next to Watson on a train one day, and Wilkins just flipped open the grant proposal to this page, didn't say anything, and Watson copied it down on a napkin. And Watson didn't do X-ray crystallography, so it didn't mean anything to him, but Crick was the person who had elucidated the structure of collagen. And so Crick was used to looking at diffraction patterns, and so using Rosalind Franklin's X-ray crystallography, they came up with the spaces between the bases and the number of bases in a helical turn. And then they developed a model in which they paid just to have like tinker toys built of the bases. And they figured out that if you have A's making hydrogen bonds with T's and G's making hydrogen bonds with C's, that there's conserved spacing between them, that the helix will be regular and smooth. But it took them a few times to do that. They messed up keto and enol forms of some of the bases at first. Okay, so Watson, Crick, and Wilkins all won the Nobel Prize for that. Franklin didn't because she was dead by the time that they gave it, and they don't give Nobel Prizes posthumously. But it's really been within the last 15 years that her story has gotten out there. Okay, mentioned when we were talking about viruses last week that some viruses will use RNA as the molecule for genetic information rather than DNA. And if you're a virus, there are some advantages to having an RNA genome, but it comes with the disadvantage of you've got a less stable molecule as your long-term memory storage. But one of the first viruses that was studied that has an RNA genome is tobacco mosaic virus. And the way that they determined that it was RNA, that basically a tobacco mosaic virus is just a spiral of RNA that's coated with a nucleocapsid. So this type of virus is a different one than the kind of phage that we were looking at earlier, where there was a big roomy capsid, and then the genome gets packaged in there. Okay. With tobacco mosaic virus, you just have this spiral, and it's basically just lightly coated with a protein that sticks to the RNA called nucleocapsid. Okay. And so you don't have this big roomy structure. You basically have a spiral of protein that's bound to the RNA inside of it. Okay. So what they did was they would take the RNA from... They had two different types of tobacco mosaic virus, A and B. They would take the RNA from type A, mix it in with protein from type B, and then they looked to see what type of virus you got at the end, and then they did the reciprocal where they took the RNA from B, mixed it in with the protein of A. And then what they found was it's not the protein that determines what type of virus you get at the end of an infection. It was the RNA that determined it. So if you had RNA from type A, you produced type A virus when you infected the tobacco leaf. If you had type B RNA, you would get a type B virus that includes type B protein. Okay? So it was the RNA that was driving it. So they determined then that in cell-based life, DNA is the molecule that stores information, but in some viruses, RNA is the molecule on which the genomes are based. Okay. We're going to go over this. I assume you guys have had this before, so I'm doing this as a little bit of review. But the primary structure of DNA. Okay. So one of the differences between DNA and RNA is the pentose molecule, that the generic structure that I expect you to know in here is that you got a pentose. Okay. And coming off of that, you've got a phosphate group. And then coming off of this, you get a nitrogenous base. Okay. And the carbons around the pentose, when you draw the pentose, just draw a house with a oxygen on the roof line, and then just start numbering from, like you're at a clock. Okay? You come down to the right from the roof line, and it's 1, 2, 3, 4, and then 5 is up here on top of the chimney. So it's like when you were drawing a house when you were a kid, all houses had chimneys. And so we've got the nitrogenous base coming off of carbon 1 and the phosphate coming off of carbon 5. But the specific pentose varies whether you're talking about DNA or RNA. DNA is short for deoxyribonucleic acid. RNA is ribonucleic acid. So their names tell you the difference in the pentose. Deoxyribose. Deoxy means missing an oxygen. And so the oxygen that's missing is here at carbon 2. In regular ribose, there's a hydroxyl and a hydrogen on each side of these first three carbons. Okay. In deoxyribose, carbon 2 doesn't have a hydroxyl group. It's got two hydrogens that come off of it. So deoxy, it's missing a carbon, or sorry, missing an oxygen off of carbon 2. And then the thing to keep in mind, it's not carbon 3, because carbon 3 is essential for polymerizing nucleic acids. That the hydroxyl coming off of carbon 3 will interact with the phosphate of the next nucleotide and form a covalent bond. Okay, here are the bases, the nitrogenous bases. Sorry, I got to think down the road a few weeks about how much I want you guys to learn this stuff. Yeah. Don't bother learning these right now. When we get to mutagenesis and mutation, that there'll be some changes in here that will convert one of these into another. But when we get to that point, we'll just put up slides. I'll put up slides that remind you of their structures. The main thing I want you to know, there are two classes of bases, purines and pyrimidines. Purines will always have two rings on them. Pyrimidines will only always have just a single ring. But what I do want you to know, which one of the bases are purines and pyrimidines? So we've got under the purines, okay, we've got adenine and guanine. Okay, and under pyrimidines, okay, thymine, got cytosine, and then uracil. And I'll put a star by uracil and another one by thymine. Okay. Uracil is normally only found in RNA. You do find it in DNA occasionally, but it's an indication of DNA damage or repair. But for the most part, if we're looking at normal DNA, you don't see uracil, you see thymine in there. In RNA, uracil replaces thymine. Okay? So this is in DNA, this is in RNA. Okay, so two rings on a purine, one ring on a pyrimidine. If we go over here and look at the base pairs that are formed, where you have A's and T's and G's and C's lining up, A's and G's are purines, and T and C are pyrimidine. So you always have a purine and a pyrimidine interacting with each other. So there are always three total rings. And so that's what allows the spacing between the two strands of DNA to be maintained, because you always have a purine and a pyrimidine. If you had two purines that interacted, you could have four rings, two pyrimidines, you would have two. That then the two strands would vary with respect to their distance apart. So since you always have a purine interacting with pyrimidine, always three total rings between the backbones of the two strands. Let's see. And this is just showing the individual bases attached to the pentose down here at carbon 1, and here's the phosphate coming off of carbon 5. So that's a good generic structure to know. Again, I don't expect you to know these specific structures right now. All right, so we've got then a molecule that is made up of two separate nucleic acid molecules. Okay, so here is one strand. So here's the phosphate coming off of carbon 5. Here's the pentose. Here's the base coming off of carbon 1. And when these are polymerized, there's a covalent bond that's formed between carbon 3 and the phosphate. It's referred to as a phosphodiester linkage. Okay. And so what that means is, we've got carbon 3 of a pentose that then is making a covalent bond to an oxygen, which is making a bond to a phosphorus, which is making a bond to an oxygen, which is making a bond to carbon 5. Okay. So the phosphodiester linkage, phosphodiester, there are two oxygens in here. That's how the pentoses are held together. Carbon 3, oxygen, phosphate, oxygen, carbon 5. Then you come down to this one, carbon 3, oxygen, phosphorus, oxygen, carbon 5. and that repeats. So you've got this constant backbone of phosphate, pentose, phosphate, pentose. There's no variation in that except for the very first nucleotide and the very last one. But all the variability takes place with these bases coming off of carbon 1. The bases are in a position to stick out to the side where they can interact. The bases are all polar molecules. Okay? So they'll have weak charges that will form on them in an aqueous environment. But this backbone is constant. And since the phosphate is coming off of carbon 5, the first nucleotide added has an intact phosphate on carbon 5. So that's referred to as the 5' end. That's the first nucleotide of a strand or of a molecule. When we talk about replication, we'll always talk about them growing away from the 5' end towards the 3' end. And at the opposite end, the last one added will have an intact hydroxyl group off of carbon 3 because the next nucleotide hasn't attacked that site. And so the last one is called the 3' end, and that's the last nucleotide added. And when scientists write DNA sequences, they always write them from 5' to 3'. Okay, that's the convention that we use when we write nucleic acid sequences. Okay, so that's one strand. If we look over here at the other strand, okay, well, we'll look at the middle first. So we've got two strands, and the bases are allowed to interact with each other. And the bases are all polar molecules, so what will happen is the bases will make hydrogen bonds with each other. And A's and T's will make two hydrogen bonds, and G's and C's will make three with each other. So if you look here, here's an A-T pair that these red dots indicate the hydrogen bonds that are formed. Here's a G-C, they can make three. Here's A-T, G-C again. So the bases will bond to their complement. A's complement is T, G's complement is C. Those are referred to as complementary base pairs. And so when you get double-stranded DNA, A will always be bound to T, T will always be bound to A. Right? Under normal conditions, A won't bind to C, G won't bind to T. Okay, A won't bind to G, C won't bind to T, that they've got their one partner that they will bind to. Okay, and then we go over here to this other strand, and it's the same backbone as we have over here, except its orientation is flipped. For the bases to line up and do this base pairing, the two strands have to be going in anti-parallel directions. So this first one is going 5' to 3' left to right. The bottom strand is going 5' to 3' right to left. They have to be going opposite directions, but their distance apart stays the same. So think about them being kind of opposite lanes on the interstate, that their distance doesn't vary, but the direction that traffic is flowing is opposite direction. Okay? That if you reverse this, the bases don't line up to allow the base pairing. So they have to be, one of the strands has to be flipped with respect to the other. So if you were going to write the sequence of this strand, that you would start down here at the 5' end, and that would be the first one, and then you write it in this direction. But you always start at the 5' end. Okay. So DNA is a double-stranded molecule. As we see here, that's one of the reasons why DNA is so much more stable than RNA, because RNA typically exists as a single-stranded molecule. And same type of configuration, 5' end, 3' end, this constant backbone of phosphate, pentose, The bases come off of carbon 1. They're exposed out to the side. They're polar molecules. They want to interact by making hydrogen bonds. So what an RNA molecule will typically do is it will start making base pairs with bases on the same strand. RNA will tend to lump up and twist up so that it makes a maximal number of hydrogen bonds with itself. That you'll still get complementary base pairing. You'll have A binding to on RNA uracil. Since there's no thymine in RNA, uracil behaves like a T, so A will bind to U, G will bind to C. But now it's twisting up on itself to facilitate those bindings since it doesn't have a complementary partner just across the street from it. Okay. So the big differences between DNA and RNA, the pentose, RNA is ribose, DNA is deoxyribose. DNA is typically a double-stranded molecule, RNA is a single-stranded molecule, and as a result, DNA is a much more durable molecule than RNA. The DNA in your cell will last for the lifetime of that cell. The RNA molecules that you produce will typically break down within a day or so. So now there's some different secondary structures. These are what Franklin was trying to elucidate, all three of these. And A form, B form, and Z form. Right now, it's a really interesting area of science because we thought for a long period of time that we knew that DNA likes this certain form. But we now know that there are some times in the life of organisms where you're more likely to find Z-form DNA. It was originally just thought that you would find it under very extreme conditions in the lab, but lately they've been isolating Z-form DNA from living things. And so the new idea now is that Z-form DNA may be a regulatory mechanism, that it gives access to different sets of genes just based on the different conformation that it has. But Z is a really odd one, that the direction of the helix actually is inverted in the Z form. It's not a big thing in your life. I just want you to know that there are multiple forms. So some of the secondary structures that can form is a hairpin structure. And this is when you get complementary bases and they will form like a stem structure. Remember, A's will want to bind to T's, G's will bind to C's. If we take this molecule, if we try to stretch it out, that those bases don't like being exposed. They want to interact with their complements. And so this will tend to form a stem loop structure where the stem is made up of base pairing to complements. And the loop structure, some of them can complement, but you need... DNA doesn't have an insignificant turning radius. So if you make a loop, you lose the ability to form hydrogen bonds on all of these. So this will be maintained. The larger this stem structure is, the more stable this structure is. Because for every A and T, you've got two base pairs holding it together. For every G and C, you've got hydrogen bond. So we've got 8, 11, we've got 13 hydrogen bonds holding this together. Okay. So that's a fairly stable structure, and it's too bad they showed this with DNA, because this is the type of structure that RNA makes all the time, just because it's got all those exposed bases. With DNA, if you separate the strands and leave individual strands separate from each other, their preference would be, if you separate two strands of DNA, they want to come back together because their exact perfect complement is right there. And it's really efficient just for them to come back together. But if you separate the strands, keep them apart, DNA will do this as well. But RNA does this all the time. This is showing, if you've got a really tight one, you just don't see these though, where there are no nucleotides up here at the turn. It takes about 5 up here. Okay, some of the other structures that you can see inverted repeats. So with an inverted repeat, okay. All right. When you've got an inverted repeat, that would be something like and then over here we've got sorry, this is a palindrome. Hang on, let me just finish this and I'll save it for a minute. Okay, this would be an inverted repeat. Okay, where you've got the same sequence and then on that strand you've got it in the opposite direction being read. So CCC, TTT, TTT, CCC would be an inverted repeat. And another class of things that you see are called palindromes, where palindromes, if you read this strand, if you come down, read the complementary strand, you get the same sequence. So GAC, GT, GAC, GT over here. What inverted repeats typically do, inverted repeats are areas where you would expect to find secondary structure. Especially the larger the inverted repeat is, and they're oftentimes protein binding sites. Or another thing that can happen is you can get inversion events at either one of these sites. Remember we talked about inversions where a piece of DNA is just taken and flipped? So inverted repeats and palindromes are pretty standard endpoints for DNA inversion events. And then if you get, you can have a long stretch of a nucleic acid, and if it's got different regions that are complementary to each other, you can get something called a cruciform structure where it will go up and these will be base paired. This will be base paired. These will be base paired and then maybe some base pairs coming off of it. And so it makes a cross-like form. So cruciform means cross-like. If you've ever read a nutritional guideline where they tell you to eat more cruciform vegetables, things like broccoli or cabbage or Brussels sprouts, they're called cruciforms because if you look at the flower when it's starting to develop, if you cut into it, that there's typically a cross shape within the developing flower. And so they're referred to as cruciforms. So anytime you see that, it means something shaped like a cross or an X will be showing up. Okay. And when we start talking about regulatory mechanisms and the stability of these molecules, we'll talk more about inverted repeats and palindromes and their specific role. See, and this is showing, I've mentioned a few times that RNA makes these convoluted structures that it wants to form base pairs. And it doesn't like to be exposed. Okay, so what will happen with RNA is it will make base pairs on itself. But if you put the same RNA molecule under the same physiological conditions, it will make the same secondary structure all the time. It will find the energetically most favorable three-dimensional shape or secondary structure and it will take on that position. If the physiological conditions change, the secondary structure of the RNA molecule will change. And one of the big areas right now that, or the big changes in the area of abiogenesis. So the idea of how did you get from molecules on a rock to living cells is the view now is that early life was probably RNA-based. And RNA has an ability that most DNA doesn't, and that is there are some RNA molecules that can act like an enzyme. Remember from 197 or the class that you took at your other school that was like 197? The only thing that proteins can do is fold and unfold. And their changes in shape is what drives their biological activity. RNA folds and unfolds. It takes on a specific three-dimensional shape based on its sequence and the way that those base pairs interact. And so, in many respects, it's like a protein, that those bases will interact with each other, much like the R groups will interact on a protein. You get a three-dimensional shape that if the physiological conditions change, the shape of the molecule will change, and you can get catalytic reactions that are driven by RNA. And so now the view of sort of the evolution of cells is you had self-replicating catalytic RNA molecules that once they came about that you would make more and more. There's a second event about the evolution of membranes that was almost equally as important as the evolution of nucleic acids. Sorry, evolution's not the best term to use there. The development, development's not good. They arose. So when we talk about RNA molecules, one of the things that I hate about textbooks and the slides that I get from textbooks, nucleic acids are always long, straight molecules, and proteins that interact with them are always either oval or circular, pastel-shaded structures. And nucleic acids are rarely straight and drawn out, and especially with RNA. I want you to think about RNA being this coiled up, wrapped up, knotted structure whenever we talk about it, because that's the form that it takes shortly after it's made to avoid having too many bases sticking out there and not interacting with complements. Okay? So, like I said, I consider DNA structure to be reviewed since this is a second level class. If you need to brush up on it, take a look at your book. There will be a very, very easy homework assignment online for you today. This is the homework assignment. I'm just tossing it. Basically, I will give you a sequence. You have to give me the complementary sequence to show me that you've got the whole A's and T's, G's and C's things. So it's 5 free points. Don't forget to do it and hand it in on Thursday. I'm going to cut you guys loose so I can run back to my office and get in a fist fight with IT people.